John Bolton on 15 March 78.
Well, during the long nights we spent keeping the recorder pen on scale at Dover Heights, I had been educating myself. I'd read 20 years Astrophysical Journal, 20 years Monthly Notices, and that kind of thing, and anything I could get hold of. And when we got these first three identifications, the people who sort of stood out in my mind were Minkowski and Lynn Laird, the elder Lynn Laird, mm-hmm. and Oort. Mm-hmm. And I wrote to all three, giving the results, you see. Now, Minkowski and Oort had both written papers on the craft.
Right.
And I remember getting a very enthusiastic letter back from Oort with two or three pages on his ideas on the Crab Nebula and mm-hmm. that kind of thing. And there was just one line at the end of the paper commenting on the other two identifications. And Jan said, of course, there are an awful lot of galaxies in the Virgo cluster.
Right.
But I mean, the thing about Oort was that he still kept that in the back of his mind. And when he went to next time to Palmar, he persuaded, I think, Bader, of course, Oort couldn't get time on Palmar telescope to
right.
take photographs of M87 in all different filters. And,
right. Did you? I think you did mention in the paper about the. No, you didn't. No. When did it come to light to you that it had this peculiar jet? Because that had been known back in around 1917 or so.
Yes, it probably had, but Oort, I think, had Bader take a whole new series of plates of Palmar, and I remember Oort writing to me from Palmar, sending an ultraviolet picture showing the jet. So Oort, I certainly wasn't aware of the earlier reference. Oort may well have been.
Well, he probably wasn't. I think it's pretty obscure sort of thing.
And but he certainly, although he dismissed the identification in this letter to me, he
had enough interest to
interest to push it. What
did you get any reaction from the other people you wrote to?
Oh yes, I wrote to Minkowski and got a letter back from Bader. I wrote back to Bader and got a letter back from Minkowski, in fact, for quite a number of years. Our correspondence went that way. If you wrote to Bader, you got a letter from Minkowski.
Anyway, what did they say when?
I forget I mean, Rudolph wrote to me. He I think was stimulated at the time to take another, try and obtain another spectrum of that central star, which of course later became the pulsar.
Right.
And he said, you know, or Bader said in this case, anything else you have, any other positions, we'd like to have them and mm-hmm. Try and follow them up. And of course we. The Puppis position, which we gave him a year later, enabled the identification of that supernova.
Right, but even right from the very earliest in 47 or 8, when you first contacted them, they had high interest.
Yes.
It wasn't only after the Cygnus A business.
No.
Yeah. That's interesting. Looking once again at this paper, I noticed that the title of it is Positions of Three Discrete Sources of Galactic Radio Frequency Radiation.
Yes.
Which I think is telling also.
Yes, well, of course, we the radiation in those days was known as galactic noise or cosmic noise.
But even though you had two reasonably identifications with extragalactic, you still wanted to call them galactic.
No, there were two kinds of noise, stellar noise and galactic noise.
I see.
Under the general heading of cosmic noise.
Okay.
These were more galactic than stellar.
Now, going to the paper with Stanley, in which you get a precise size for Cygnus A, and the declination was 1 degree off. Let's see, I guess I didn't have any specific questions on that one. You had a follow-up paper in the Australian Journal of Scientific Research on that with much more detail. Ah, yes, there was a thing where you broke the Cygnus A radiation up into two components, the variable and the steady, and you said there's a steep slope on the variable, which makes sense, but the steady slope, it seemed like you had a peak at 100, so that you give a sketch of a turnover at around 100 megahertz. Mm. Do you remember how this might have come about? Or?
Well, I think if you add those, you get a steep slope. This is just the sort of average characteristic of the scintillating component of that period.
I see. So it was just an incorrect subtraction of the scintillating component.
No, I don't think it was an incorrect subtraction of the scintillating component.
Okay,
at 60 megahertz, it's all scintillations, so there's no steady component. So it must peak.
Oh,
at 200 megahertz, you see no scintillations, so it's all steady.
Yes.
At 100, you see half scintillations, but the 100 total has gone up much more than 200. And then at 60, it's all scintillating, so the steady component must go down under that definition.
But in fractional amount, yes, but not necessarily in the absolute amount of variation.
Yes, the absolute amount goes to zero. Or is going to zero. It's all scintillations, let's say, at 40 megahertz.
Oh, I see, I see. Ah, yes. Now the picture is coming to me. Right, right. So basically, it's a confused concept. Here you're thinking, well, what were you thinking at this stage? You hadn't yet gone to New Zealand, I believe.
No, oh no.
So what were your thoughts on the cause of the scintillation? I think in the paper you're very noncommittal.
Well, I think Bruce Lee certainly always thought it was scintillation.
Ionospheric.
Yes.
Yeah, you say the question of its nature is left open for the present.
Mm.
But what were you thinking, though? I mean, in your own mind, can you put yourself at that time?
Well, I don't think we knew. By analogy with the sun, it just looked like another sun. So the sun does exactly the same thing.
Right.
The variable component is something which is much stronger at low frequencies. So I guess it was the solar analogy which...
And that would also not put it that far away from the solar system
no.
if you scaled it down.
Mm. We didn't know. The New Zealand experiment was designed to find out.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've just heard people say that it was quite clear to them that around 46 or 47 that it must be ionospheric. And I've been a little bit puzzled by that, whether they just were sort of biased in their mind or whether they really had some evidence for that.
Who would you say?
Well, I'm afraid I really can't remember names, but I think it was, really there wasn't that much clear evidence, but they just always assumed it was ionospheric and it was just a matter of someone going out and proving it.
We had no evidence, and as I say, the varying component got larger as one went towards low frequencies, which was exactly the same thing the sun did. And we knew that the solar variations were intrinsic. Spaced aerial experiments had been done on the sun.
Mm-hmm.
And we naturally took the spaced aerial experiment on the sun as our control experiment for the scintillation.
Right.
So,
No, that makes perfect good sense. Moving on to the paper by yourself, that's one question I wanted to ask, is the others have been in association with Stanley and or Slee. I was wondering how this one came to be only by yourself. Do you remember how that came about?
I don't know. I was sticking my neck out a bit. I think that was one thing.
I didn't ask Bruce that. Maybe I should have.
Well, Bruce wasn't working with us at that time.
Oh, he wasn't yet with you then? He came in for the first time, yes, with his identifications.
Yes. Now, well, he wasn't actually part of the identification team. It was Stanley and I who did the work, but then we did use some of Bruce's Dover Heights measurements to clear up one or two points
I see.
On that. And, well, I think in the case of the Cygnus experiments on Cygnus, Stanley and I had actually worked together. I mean, we'd sat up at nights together, we'd gone to various places to see if we could get a higher cliff together, and we'd done that all together. But the major observations on those other sources and so on, there essentially were all my observations. Stanley at the time had gone back to building equipment and that kind of thing.
I see.
And so it was essentially my own sitting up at nights and so on, mm-hmm, which got those.
And like you say, it was a bit of a risky sort of paper.
Yes, but I mean, others were not really involved in the observations for it.
Right. It seems like...
the point of that paper to say, well, you know, the first one is not unique. There's a whole class of these things. We're starting a new branch of astronomy.
Yeah, right. They're all over.
They're all over. Yeah. That's right. But then, of course, the Stanley was in on the New Zealand position-finding observations, and Bruce did some of the backup observations from Dover Heights. He'd been in on the scintillation part of it, very obviously. And so the next paper was by a lot of us. Of course, this was a departure from tradition in including those people in papers.
Technicians, basically.
In papers.
Yeah. Yeah, other people have mentioned that to me. Was this a policy of Bowen's, or how did this come about?
No, it was a policy of mine.
Hmm. It's more common today.
Yes, it's very common today.
At that time, it was... unusual.
Yes, probably this was just as a I'd done a lot of experimental flying and that kind of thing during the war, and I always recognized the people who kept my airplane together, and it seemed to me that
if they should get proper credit, yeah.
And it did become a radio physics model.
Yeah. No, I know that. Looking at this Bolton 48 Nature article, it seems like, indeed, that you have been looking at some basic astronomy texts and reading journals and so forth, because you speculate on what the nature of these radio stars, as they came to be known, might be, and you... I gather that you couldn't make the main sequence because the Sun wasn't... Well, that's not true. The Sun was like Cygnus anyway, but the others were not scintillating so much. So you said they're either post-main sequence or pre-main sequence, and you know, maybe like a planetary nebula or a contracting star. Is my reasoning right there, that you just sort of took the other two kinds of stars that were known?
Yes.
Let me ask you another question. Were you unusual in this sort of methodical past 20 years of Astrophysical Journal and monthly notices? Were other people doing this? I haven't heard anyone else talk about learning
project. Yeah, I think I would be, yes. Yes. I think other people certainly... I think an effort was made to go into solar physics. I mean, this was how Steve Smerd got his start. Pawsey one day said, you know, he'd like Steve to give a lecture on the sort of basic physics of the Sun and the solar atmosphere. 30 years later, Steve is still preparing this lecture.
Yes, other people boned up on the particular area that they were in, but I mean, sort of a general education, self-education. Yes. I haven't heard anyone mention that. All right, now... the other paper that I have a copy of here is your paper on Taurus A with Stanley. And You call it, in the abstract, one of the minor discrete sources of galactic radio frequency noise, but I suppose minor refers to the fact that it's a small fraction of the galactic radiation. But I thought that was sort of funny. Why in Table 2 do you give times in units of minutes and 15ths of a minute?
Because that was our measuring.
On the strip chart or something?
Yes.
I see.
Minutes and 15ths of a minute is approximately, wait a minute, what's the 15ths of a minute? 4 seconds.
One minute of arc, yeah.
Yes.
Somehow that one got by the referee. That's a rather non-SI unit there. Let's see.
That was the smallest sensible unit.
Sort of your accuracy also.
Compared to the scatter, which refraction and everything else gave us.
Right.
I think it was essentially the minute of arc, which... after all, you made your own rules in those days.
Yes, that's true also.
One of the biggest difficulties I ever had was getting the concept of antenna temperature.
Why was that?
This was not a recognized... Now it's a very recognized concept. But Westfeld and I wrote a paper... Burgess was one person.
He had a paper during the wartime.
And Westfeld and I showed that antenna temperature, in fact, was proper physics.
What about the Dickey paper, 46? Was that not part of your knowledge at that time?
Oh, yes, the Dickey paper was. These things, the temperature concept had sort of been used loosely, and we showed that it was valid physics to use antenna temperature.
Mm-hmm.
And
this was in an internal lab report?
No, this was in one of the papers we produced.
Oh, it's in one of the Bolton and Westfold series.
Bolton and Westfold series. The fact that antenna, I mean, Westfold is sort of somewhat pedantic, and I sort of convinced him that this was a reasonable physical concept, and Kevin produced the mathematics to show that it indeed was a valid physical concept. But it wasn't generally used.
No.
The Americans actually took up the concept of antenna temperature when they came in large numbers.
Perhaps because they were working at higher frequencies, for instance, the NRL group and so forth, where it perhaps works a little bit more clear-cut fashion anyway. Let's see now. That takes care of all of the papers through 1950. However, perhaps you should tell me some more about your trip to New Zealand and so forth. For instance, you mentioned to me before we started recording about you didn't get any useful Cygnus A position in New Zealand. Why was that?
I'm not quite sure. It was probably the time of year at which we were observing and the interference from spread F. What we had hoped to do with Cygnus was in fact to count the fringes to transit to get a second handle on the declination. Our fringe separation in New Zealand was roughly a quarter of a degree.
We were on a higher cliff there.
Yes, we were on a higher cliff there. But unfortunately what happened was that near transit, the fringes get very long, and after transit, we never really, even though we had a clear horizon to the setting point, I think the ionosphere broke up our interference pattern so badly that we didn't, in fact, get very good data.
I see.
And when we moved across to the west coast, we again didn't get very good data, whereas the data on the Crab, on M87 and NGC 5128, which were at different times of the day, were really good. You see, Cygnus was transiting somewhere around midnight, which is the local maximum transiting setting was nearly midnight, and this is the maximum spread F.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the other objects were in times where scintillations, spectral scintillation is very low.
So this was useful for the correlation of ionospheric stuff.
Yes.
But not for source position.
Yes, so, you see, yeah. There are two problems. One is spread F, which has a sort of local maximum at midnight, and sporadic E, which has local maximum at midday. Now, it so happened on, I think, Crab and MH7 that we were clear of midnight and midday. Centaurus wasn't so good, but Cygnus was rather ruined the position of Cygnus. In fact, we never published our Cygnus position because we knew it was closer to 42 degrees than 43 degrees. But mm-hmm. weren't able really to pin it down.
Yeah.
In fact, I don't think we were ever able to successfully identify the setting fringe.
I see. And you went to two different sites in New Zealand, I believe.
Yes.
What was the purpose of two sites?
Well, the first site we had theoretically a view of Cygnus right through.
Facing to the north.
And, yes. Yeah. North and east. And this gave us also rising patterns of the Crab MH7 and NGC 5128. And we had to move to the setting site, we had to move to a west coast site to get the setting patterns for the other three objects.
Okay, the survey by Stanley and Slee are the authors. It's sort of the first major survey to come from the Australian work, published in 1950. Mm. Once again, I might ask why you were not an author on that work.
Well, there was quite a lot. What was the date of that?
50. It was submitted in November 49.
The work on that was, in fact, just as much due to Kevin Westfold and me as it was to Stanley and Slee. And this was a case where we simply split the publication between four names on paper seemed a little large, so Westfold and I took the General Galactic Survey and published it, and Stanley and Slee took the source population and published
it. It was really all four of you working on all
It was all four of us working on the same thing. In fact, I think you'll find acknowledgements backwards and forwards.
Yeah.
When it came to the sea interferometer, all the phenomena on the sea interferometer were Bruce Slee and I wrote that up. When it came to work on scintillations, I think Slee and I also wrote that up.
When it came to
trying to model the galactic background, it was Westfold and I did. So, I mean, the splitting up was just...
And this survey then was the a complete southern sky survey.
Not complete because it didn't cover the same polar regions because they don't set and rise and set.
Okay, everything you could get from the sequence interferometer anyway, and you have 22 sources in here, most of which turn out in hindsight to be legitimate.
A larger fraction.
Well, yes.
Was customary in those days.
What were your impressions at this stage of the development of radio sources? Where this was just about exactly the time as the 1C survey, which had about 50 sources, and so you probably had a preprint of that about this time. Also, what were you thinking about the nature of these radio sources? And
about the nature.
Was this telling you anything when you could begin to do some statistics as to where they were located in the sky and their distribution and intensity? Or was this too early?
No, I think at that stage it was too early. We'd done this work, here we pass it on to the general scientific public.
Okay, so you didn't have any great conclusions
the end of how far we could, we'd gone as far as we could go without new equipment. This was done with the 9-Yagi array, which Westfold and I did the general background survey with, and our next stage was to build a rather larger sea interferometer, which had I think a 6x2 Yawkey system, some azimuth resolution, higher azimuth resolution in this case. And
somewhat more sensitivity.
Somewhat more sensitivity, and that paper, I think, which came out in 1953, did have some statistics to it. I think that might have been me, Stanley, and Slee.
54, 104 radio sources.
That's right. At 100 megahertz. This is the first time we mentioned log N log S, which was anomalous. I mean,
yeah. Something I've never actually done or even thought about is a cross correlation of this survey with the 1C, Ryle Smith and Elsmore, I believe it is. Did you do that in the regions of overlap? You remember?
I don't think there was any correlation.
Even at this early stage, you mean this pattern was set? I'll have to do that. I just don't remember any comments on that either side at that time. But do you remember doing it at that time? I would think it'd be an obvious thing to want to do.
I remember noting that the source in Ursa Major was exactly 12 hours different from the source in Cassiopeia.
Well,
same declination.
From the Nature article, they'd gotten rid of that by the time they published the.
So that's the only thing. No, we at the sort of, what was the date of that one? 1950
was published.
1950, yes.
Yeah, and the other was published that same year.
Yes. And then, of course, after that, Westfeld and I had, got busy doing, what can we find out with an interferometer? How accurate is it? And that was when we started building the 80-foot dish in the ground.
The hole in the ground.
Going to higher frequencies.
Okay, well, let's talk about the hole in the ground dish. First of all, where did that idea come from?
Well, I suppose it was me.
But, I mean, had you heard of the concept somewhere else, or you just said, well, this is something that's sort of an obvious thing to do?
No, I think it's just an obvious thing to do, and it really came out of Westfeld's and my work, that one had to get some primary gain into the antennas. And we built this as an experimental antenna at the same time as Stanley started to devote his attention to how to get sensitivity at higher frequencies.
I see.
We actually worked the antenna first at 160 megahertz, but it was intended to work at 400.
Right. In terms of the accuracy of the surface.
And that dish was, and its receiver, were really the prototype for the Caltech dishes.
I see. They are a similar size, that's right.
Mm. And the receiver technology was taken directly mm-hmm. to the Caltech dish.
What, you chose this over a, say, a 30-foot steerable thing, which might have been feasible at that time, at least as a transit instrument. Simply because you wanted to have that additional gain?
Additional resolving
power. Oh, you wanted the resolution?
Yes.
Yeah, now tell me, while we're recording here, what you told me before about the colloquium, the talk that you and Westfold gave at this time.
Well, I guess this must have been a talk somewhere around 1951. We gave a talk which we titled Discernibility and Detectability. And showed that, in fact, one's ability to detect objects far exceeded one's ability to discern objects. And one of the things that we got laughed down at was proving that with our 17-degree 9-Yawkey array, although we could detect many hundreds of sources, in fact, we could only sort out what corresponded to one source per 4 or 5 beam areas, and we were really laughed at for that.
And what was the point of disagreement?
I don't think anybody understood. I mean, an interference pattern is something which is terribly real and terribly false. That's to say,
in terms of assigning
the sum of n sine waves is still a sine wave.
Yes, yes, right.
And that is the thing that we could not get across, that you want one cannot
that
sort
the interpretation
things.
Is the interpretation is laden with difficulty. Yes. Yes,
and the reason we found, I mean, we found this out empirically by in our crossed two aerials on the Crib interrupter, and we could move one of the aerials with respect to the other, and although we had a pattern, we'd get inference patterns, which were cross patterns, sure, that we could think we could sort out sources.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as we went to another spacing, we'd sort out a different lot of sources.
Yeah, right, yeah. And this was already clear, though, from your first few sources, where you had a couple that happened to be near each other in the sky, mm. and the two patterns were beating. And and I guess it wasn't quite so clear to the solar people, because they only had the one big source.
Yes.
So that's, of course, an interesting thing that you had there in the light of the late 50s with the controversies over the confusion and so forth, as we call
yes,
it.
Yes, well, of course, our, I think, well, this 1954 paper gave us 100 sources and so on, and we had found the steep slope of the log n log s, and at the end of that paper I dismissed it as the kind of thing that happens with clustering. Because if you look at the log n, log s in the Shapley-Ames catalogue, it's dominated by the Virgo cluster, and mm-hmm. it gives you a steep log n, log s.
So that you mean that we just happened to be located in a region where there was a...
Yeah, well, I had no inclination, I had no... I had to throw in some suggestion, and mm-hmm. clustering was one of the things which could clearly do it.
Well, let's see, are you talking about the concept that we have to be located somewhat in a hole so that there are fewer strong
it's
sources?
It's the same thing.
Same yeah. thing that came up later
yes.
that
yes.
Hoyle came up with and so mm. forth. Yeah. But now, by that time, were you thinking of these sources as being primarily extragalactic?
Yes. Yes, I was. And
when did that changeover take place? Was it Cygnus that did it for you? Or?
No, I think it was purely theoretical. In fact, I remember at one meeting we had in Sydney when Sir Harry Massey was out and wanted to hear about radio astronomy, and we had a joint meeting with Stromlo, and I remember having an argument with Woolley. And I said that I felt these things were galaxies because I couldn't see the energy density being produced in the stellar atmosphere to give these signals, that they had to be minutes of arc across, in other words, the source temperature.
Yeah.
Even though I didn't know anything about synchrotron radiation or what the limits on brightness temperature were, I felt they had to have a large emitting volume. But this was just a...
Even though, of course, that meant their luminosity became tremendous.
Yes.
But when you go to a galaxy, you have
yes.
more resources also.
Yes.
Yeah. And then that would be about...
I mean, by that time we had recognized that all the galactic radiation wasn't going to break up into point sources, I think.
And what was the basis of that?
Simply that it didn't.
With higher resolution it was still...
Yes, that there was an underlying smooth component. I mean, Westfeld and I argued that number densities that were required to hide sources, you see. And
right.
I remember one day we eventually got down to saying, well, you know, it's got to be individual electrons, essentially.
Well, but hold it now. In one of your papers with Westfold, you have a model
mm.
in which almost all of the radio sources are closer than 40 parsecs, and you give an actual density of these radio stars. I believe that's correct. I don't seem to find... Oh, here we go. In 51, in one of those series, you talk about an isotropic component, which might be extragalactic, and a galactic distribution of radio stars, less than about 1 in 10,000 per parsec. I'm sorry, less than 1 ten-thousandth per parsec. The average observed radio source much more luminous than the Sun at a distance less than 40 parsecs.
Mm.
So, this was 51 now, mm. so probably written around 50. So at that stage, you still apparently were thinking of the radio star idea. Mm. Can you remember when this
Yes, I think the changeover probably came in 51 to 52 when I felt that, you know, there was a smooth radiation mm-hmm. from our galaxy and these other things, and that the extragalactic, the majority of the discrete sources were extragalactic and had to be galaxies. In other words, to give them a large, a moderate volume emissivity. Now, of course, the pulsars have proved.
Well, yes, but that's
the exception. But one's
really irrelevant to the early 1950s.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about the work that.
No, I think if you can ever get hold of the proposal I wrote to Caltech by 1955, although I've been out of the subject for a long time. And that proposal was remarkable, came remarkably true. The thing that was obvious then, I think, was that there was a difference in, we did have galactic sources, and we did have extragalactic sources, but one of the distinguishing characteristics was that the galactic sources had the same dimensions optically as radio.
Mm-hmm.
The extragalactic sources had much larger dimensions mm-hmm. than the radio, and that one of the ways of getting at the identifications was to look at the structure and say, well, we've got a 4-minute-of-arc source. This is either a 4-minute-of-arc nebula, galactic nebula, or it's a 1/2-minute-of-arc galaxy.
And for some reason, the radio emission is outside.
And for some reason, the radio emission is outside.
I'm trying to think now, what else was there besides Cygnus in terms of a large radio galaxy?
The Bernie Mills work, our cross the interferometer, had shown that the Fornax source was sort of
Fornax,
half
that's
a degree.
Right. The Centaurus, right. There was still only a handful, but
there's still only a
but
handful.
It was a definite pattern, yeah.
Yes, but there was a definite.
No pattern. Extragalactic source. Was small.
The known supernova remnants, the Crab and the Puppis source. And so on were the same size optically.
Yeah.
As I say, the radio description was the optical description.
But might there have been a bit of a selection effect there, because the upper limits to sizes that one could give at that time were something of the order of a minute of arc. Well, there might have been some galaxies that were bigger than that. What I'm saying is that it might not have been possible to establish at that date that a radio source was smaller than the optical image that was associated with. All you could find was that it was larger.
Oh yes, I mean there was a great spate of interferometry around 1952. Henry Brown's work, Bernard Mills' work.
Right, but only on a couple of the strongest sources.
That's right.
That's all you could do it on.
Yeah.
And
but I mean the thing that sort of I think that gave a very clear indication that structurally the galactic sources were similar in radio as they were optically, and the extragalactic sources were very much more extended.
Okay.
Not true, of course, for things like quasars.
Which is, once again, a later story. Well, let's talk about the Bolton and Westfold papers, in which you switched from the discrete sources to the galactic background at 100 megahertz, but from what we've been saying, this really wasn't a switch in your mind at this time. It was just a different aspect of the same problem, I guess.
Yes, I mean, we built for the first time a steerable antenna.
Right. And didn't use the C interferometer technique.
Well, we used the same. Actually, the 9-Yagi steerable antenna was on an equatorial mount, but it had a third axis in it, which when you pointed it to the C, you could rotate.
So the
declination axis became the horizontal axis.
Oh, I see. Huh.
Yes, it had a broken declination shaft in it.
I see.
With a rotation.
But what I'm getting at is, from an astronomical point of view, you were, in your mind at that time, you would consider this just a different aspect of the same problem as the discrete sources.
Well, we had some radiation.
Yeah,
it was our job to study it.
Right. What do you think were the primary results that came out of that 100 megahertz survey?
The galactic radiation one?
Yes.
Well, that our antenna was too small.
The resolution you had, I think, was 17 degrees. Mm. Yeah. Nevertheless, I think it did give you some hints.
Well, I mean, there were technical problems like establishing the establishing the temperature scale.
Because there was no cold area.
Matching the receivers to antennas and that kind of thing. That was one of the first large antennas on which spherical integration was used to determine the gain of it. And
spherical integration, I'm sorry, I don't know.
Spherical integration of the beam pattern.
By using a transmitter or something? Or
yes.
Mm-hmm. And actually, well, since you bring it up, was that transmitter far enough away, as it turned out? Someone else was just telling me about...
It was the sun.
Oh, you used the sun. Oh, is it? Someone else used a transmitter a mile or so away, and then it turned out
that
was
Christensen who
there was a calibration error
on them.
Mm. Yeah. They didn't realize how far the far field was, essentially. Okay, but you clearly realized you didn't have enough resolution, but yet, nevertheless, you seem to have plunged into quite a bit of analysis of this survey, with Westfold, I assume, sort of churning away on models and this sort of thing. In fact, you even went so far as to jump into the argument of trailing arms versus leading arms. What was that based on?
Well, it was based on the angle of the the concentration in Cygnus.
But what you see on the two-dimensional sky is, I'm just not quite sure here how you can see whether it's trailing or leading.
I couldn't answer that question at this stage.
I'm afraid I haven't looked at the paper.
It's all disappeared
only
in the history so much.
You can see a concentration for an arm.
Well, it was based on the angle between the... We knew which way the galaxy was going round.
Right.
I forget what it was based on now, but it led to quite some arguments for a few years.
Yes, yes. What about these secondary peaks that, of course, had shown up in earlier surveys by Reber and so forth? You have the one in Cygnus, then you have Sagittarius. Was it beginning to become clear from this survey that Sagittarius might be more than just a diffuse concentration?
Well, no, our work on Sagittarius really didn't get going until we got the 8-foot hole in the ground.
Okay, so at this stage then you weren't really thinking of it as a discrete source in any sense?
No, although Piddington found it as a discrete concentration at, I think, 25 centimeters.
At higher frequencies, yeah.
And then McGee and I, with the 8-foot-ish, really mapped that region. I mean, building the 8-foot hole in the ground, I think, was partly dominated by the fact that we could see the Centaurus source and we could see the region of the center of the galaxy. Mm-hmm.
So what you're saying is this is another strong point for such an antenna that these things went near the zenith. And,
yes.
And
well, we did have the choice of building it off axis. I mean, we could have built it on the slope.
Well, that's true.
In fact, it was very difficult to build it straight up.
Why was that?
With the configuration of the land, we had an awful lot of sand to move.
I see. But once again, that's getting a little bit ahead. Another interesting thing is that in the 1950 paper on the 100 megahertz survey, you used a type of restoration of the beam.
Mm.
Where did the idea for this come about?
I can't really remember. I suppose I must have suggested it to Kevin and. We simply got going on it.
At that stage...
It's very similar, in fact, nowadays to the CLEAN programs.
Well, is it really?
Yes, the iteration process which we used said it shouldn't produce any holes.
You were not bothered at all by... I don't imagine at this stage you're sort of thinking in terms of the Fourier theory, which Bracewell brought in. a few years later.
Well, in fact, we did Fourier transform.
So I see, in the mathematical analysis of this restoration, but you had no philosophical